Now we're at lesson two in Romans, a gospel-centered world. And in this particular lesson, which goes from Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through the end of the chapter, verse 32, we really get a question or the idea from Paul that in his estimation, as he is talking about to the Romans about all of this, that he's dealing with the causes and the results of ignoring God and ignoring what God would have us to do, what that does to us, and how we can really know what God would have us do. And then when we choose to ignore it, what does that result in? That results, he would say, in allowing, and I think your lesson writer even said, in allowing sin to grow, sin to flourish, not just to grow a little bit, but presumably at some point to grow unchecked if we're not careful. I guess opening questions. Why do some people seek God and believe and others choose to ignore the evidence of his existence? There are people out there that try to ignore the evidence of his existence, right? What's the difference? Why do some people choose, and that's one of the questions, why do some people choose to seek God and believe, and yet others choose to ignore? Could be home where you're brought and raised. Okay, do like to please, you know. Right. Well, and just like we said this morning, a lot of folks, the gospel is offensive because it involves accountability. Whether you're accountable to other people around here, and in some instances that was the case in the early Christian church and even beyond, you're at least accountable to God, and people don't want to be accountable, right? So some choose to ignore God's existence because that means they might have to be accountable for something. They might have to believe in something or someone outside of themselves, and it's really kind of an ego thing, right? It's me, me, me kind of thing. Of course, if you've never heard of God, are there ways that you can still know of God? Okay, how?
Well, you've got
choose to know.
But, I mean, you know, I didn't think I was brought up into it.
Right.
So the way I got started a while ago, but now someone coming from outside, I don't know if they get into a spirit like Paul or something like that, or if they get curious and delve and start getting spiritually connected. And, well, I mean, there's so many ways it can happen.
Well,
a miracle, for instance. Who was it?
Yeah, Constantine had a vision that if he would change and fight under this banner or this symbol, he would win the battle. And so the symbol was a cross, and he changed all of his standards to that. He won the battle, and he said, okay. That's kind of like Rahab. Yeah, Rahab, the prostitute, she was a Canaanite. She lived in Jericho. She worshipped the Canaanite gods, but she was convinced that the Hebrews were going to, their God was going to let them take the land, and so she helped those spies. She saved them, and she said, okay, I've saved you, I've helped you. Now, when you take the land, everybody's scared of you. We all believe that your God can give you the land, and when you do, I want you to save my family. And so they said, okay, we'll make that agreement. Said, and just make sure you gather your family here, and no matter what you hear outside the door, don't let anybody open and stick the head out, because if it gets chopped off, it's their own fault, because they opened the door and stuck the head out. You know, kind of thing. And so, sure enough, Rahab and her family were saved. And according to some of the later Jewish traditions, Rahab converted to Judaism and early Judaism and began to worship God. You think? Yeah. She had worshipped all these others, but she found that they were really not gods. You know, and a lot of animistic kind of peoples, animism, where there's anima in all of nature. That is, those their spirits in all of nature, et cetera, that animate them. You know, a lot of people do that, but they seek gods in nature, and then we have to find ways to help them to do that. There are a lot of those kinds of folks out there today. By the way, there are. I had a student not long ago. I've mentioned the student who now is part of a Satru, which is a resurrection of the ancient Norse gods, in particular Thor. But had another student that wrote in a paper did in a world religions class, did something on New Age and as a Wiccan, and talked about Wiccan, which is not what you would think as black magic kind of stuff, but is a resurrection of ancient paganism to the form of trying to manipulate nature for good. That there are spirits out there in nature. And so the real question there is, how do we, when we encounter those kinds of folks, how do we help folks see the true God as opposed to those that are not? And that's part of what Paul is dealing with here as well. Choice. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but we've used the word choice at least a dozen times in the last few minutes. Most people, or the question, I guess, is, do you think that most people who ignore God do so as a conscious choice or simply ignorant of the fact? A little of both. But to totally ignore God's probably a lot of it's by choice. Yeah. But, you know, there can be some ignorance. We still haven't reached everybody in the world. There's still a large number of languages and dialects into which no biblical text has been translated. So, you know, there are still those things. And yet, what's really interesting is throughout most of the major world religions, there are certain key things that tend to run through them, which should help to convince even more folks that there is a God out there that has planted this within those folks. So what are some of the dangers and effects of ignoring God then? And you might go to hell, as my student Brad, as my former student Brad said. Well, actually, Hades is different from hell in the New Testament. Hades is temporary and hell is permanent. Hades as opposed to Gehenna. Hades, in fact, in the book of Revelation at the end, Hades will give up the souls of its dead and Hades will be cast into the lake of fire, which is at the heart of Gehenna and burned up. Interesting read, and if anybody wants to, I can make copies, or you can take my copy of Josephus and read. Interesting read is his essay to the group on Jewish beliefs in Hades and hell. But you might go there, okay? What are some of the other consequences of ignoring God? Some of the dangers. Okay, well, there are. Maybe a worse life. Some of the particular dangers, in case you didn't read, are on page 48. Those are some of the dangers. Wickedness, that's willful, ongoing involvement in sin. Failure to give God glory, failure to give God thanks. Purposeless living. No real purpose. Mindless living, seeking glory in things, or worshiping the created order. This, at some point in time, off in the future, if the world lasts long enough, there are going to be folks, and my father was also convinced and told me this a long time ago, and it's probably true, and I will have helped them come to this conclusion because of all of them that I lost over the years. There are going to be some folks that are going to start digging around in lakes and streams and in the woods, and they're going to come up and wonder, what are these little round things with dimples in them that people have been worshiping? Those golf eggs. Golf balls. Yeah. Now, I've lost more than four. I just try to get through a round of golf without losing more than two. I figure I've had a successful time. But, you know, so Paul is dealing with these kinds of things. He wrote Romans. Paul actually wrote Romans while he was in Corinth. And we've talked about the Corinthian church and all the different, in Corinth, you had all the different temples, etc. In fact, one of the especially important temples was the temple of whom? Aphrodite. And part of the worship of Aphrodite involved what? Temple prostitution. cultic prostitution, where adherents would, as at in particular at certain festivals. Have you been to Corinth? No. You seem to know a lot. No. It was in Sunday school, in a Sunday school lesson. Yeah. Not only that, I've said that too. And you know, Aristophanes coined the word Corinthia zestai, which means to commit fornication. And the word and the name Corinth is in there. So you know, but Aphrodite and also the cult of Isis, female god out of Egypt, was very, very important. And part in both of those, part of the worship of Aphrodite and of Isis involved cultic prostitution, the priestesses, and that's. There is a chance, or some who think that that's what's mentioned in verses 24 and 25 of chapter 1. Therefore God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And there are some scholars who think that that is a particular reference probably to those kinds of cultic practices. It didn't just happen with Aphrodite or Isis. It also happened in the cult of Dionysus and the cult of Orpheus, which was a reformed Dionysiac cult. There were those kinds of things as well. And he says, those things resulted from idolatry, but they also fed into more idolatry. It simply grew. That idolatry grew. So, why does that happen? Well, Paul claims, initially here, human ignorance. People ignore, but not human ignorance as in we don't know about God, but human ignorance as we choose to ignore God. Starting here in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. In other words, they know that there's truth out there, they know that God's out there, but they have chosen to suppress the truth and to continue to live in suppressing that truth. You know, he says, humans have chosen to ignore the truth about God, and therefore they ignore the true God. They don't care about what God wants, and turn to worshiping false gods. And so, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Now, how has God done that? Ever since the creation of the world, His invisible nature, namely His eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. Snake worshippers, snake handlers. Right? I mean, here we've got this idea that people, though they know the truth, that God's out there and they can see it around them, they choose to ignore it, they choose to suppress it, and therefore they keep other people from coming to know it, and it only exacerbates the problem. With this in mind, then Paul, who earlier talked about the good news, verses 1 to 17, suddenly jumps in on wickedness and destruction. He goes to the antithesis, God's wrath. God's wrath. Although it's an echo, for in the righteousness of God, verse 17, is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. The wrath of God here is not some emotional thing where we get angry and stomp our feet and huff and blow. What does he mean by the wrath of God here? Do what? Right. Okay. Yeah. His wrath. It's not an angry stomp my foot kind of thing. The wrath of God is the only way that God can react to evil. God is righteous, and the only way to react to evil in righteousness is through this wrath, this judgment. It's not getting mad, getting angry, but that evil is so opposite of what God is and what God wants, Paul says in his diatribe, that, you know, anything that's contrary to God's righteousness, God, this holy God, that's His reaction to sin's presence. Because it is so opposite. It's not a psychological category. It's a symbol of the retribution that comes when people willfully turn from God. And it's not that God throws a lightning bolt. It's not that God sits around and says, okay, let's see. Steve said this about this old preacher, and he's out there practicing basketball on a Sunday. I think it's time for me to zap him and rip his Achilles tendon. I actually had a ministerial student tell me that when that happened. Because he had talked about Oliver B. Green and how wonderful Oliver B. Green was. And I said, well, got to be careful about those kind of things. Besides, Oliver B. Green was dead at the time. But although his sons kept it alive, I don't know if he's still on the radio or not. But I jumped up for a rebound on a Sunday afternoon, practicing for a faculty versus student basketball game, and my right Achilles completely snapped. And he went and told people, and even told my friend Jim Pitts at Furman. He called Jim Pitts and said, Dr. Pitts, aren't you your friend, the professor? And he said, yes. Well, I want to tell you what God did to him, because he laid his long tongue of slander on Oliver B. Green. Jim said, I laughed at him, said, Tony. His name was Tony Berardo. By the way, about 15 years later, I got a letter from Tony Berardo apologizing. Said he had gone into ministry and he was living in a halfway house, supervising folks in a halfway house. He said, I decided maybe you weren't so crazy and wrong after all. No. No, but my friend Jim Pitts said, Tony, if God was into that, there's not a one of us that'd still be walking around today. So it's not that God is doing that, but rather we'll find a key phrase that occurs three times in this passage is, God gave them over to. God gave them over to. God gave them over to. God didn't zap folks and say, well, I'm going to get you today. But God, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then I'm going to let you run with it. What did we used to say? Give a fellow enough rope and he'll hang himself, right? Give a fellow enough rope and he'll hang himself. He says, I'm going to let you run. But when you get to the end of that rope, you just hope that it doesn't snap when the pit bull's on the other end. But, you know, you get to the end. You ever watch a dog go running? They're getting in, boom. And then they get back and run again. About the third time they decided, better not run and get there, right? It jerks them back. But here, what he's saying is, this wrath of God, this righteousness of God can't stand against the negative, the sinfulness. And so, what happens is God gives them over to their own idolatry, hoping that they will learn and come back. But if they don't, then they get whatever comes. Now, Paul is influenced by a number of folks in this, not only his Jewish upbringing. And it seems kind of harsh when he says they've got no excuse. But we also find that he relies on some things that actually didn't make it into the canon as such, but in the Wisdom of Solomon, which is in the Apocrypha, chapters 13 to 19. There are, which is in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures in 250 B.C. There are some phrases, there's some phrasing that is in there that Paul would have known in his education. All that time that he spent, those 17 years as well, where he talks about this and he says there's no excuse. God has given you this, God has put it out there, there's no excuse for you not to know. In fact, according to Luke Timothy Johnson, and I tend to agree with him, Paul sees idolatry as a rebellion of the heart, not a mistake of the mind. What's the difference? A rebellion of the heart, not a mistake of the mind. Yes? Go ahead. In the heart. And the heart was where you made your deepest decisions. It wasn't a place of emotion like we think. It had nothing to do with Valentine's Day and that fluttery feeling. In fact, with Judaism, the heart was the seat of the intellect. You still had your mind, but the heart was where you made those, it was the center of your body here. It was key. It was where you made those deep, dark decisions. Actually, the motion of love came from the bowel. That's where they thought love resided, in the gut. Because when you're around somebody, especially early on, you know, your stomach churned and all, well, that must be where love comes from. Hey, he didn't know it was indigestion. He thought it was love. Yeah. But, you know, so idolatry is rebellion of the heart. It's not that you've made a mistake with your mind, but it's that conscious choosing in your heart. Johnson goes on to say, idolatry is a disease of human freedom, of humans suppressing the truth, suggesting a conscious and willful choice against God. End quote. That's what idolatry is. You've chosen to idolize. I know that's not relevant as we're here in the 21st century. Yeah. I was so happy when Dallas finally bit the big one, because I got my Friday night TV show at that time slot back. And I was so glad after the first two or three seasons that Mary decided she wasn't going to watch American Idol anymore until it came to the final three or four episodes. And then finally, guess what? Nah, we don't watch The Voice. But American Idol is done. Yes, this was the last season. The last idol. All these idols. But how many of those American idols actually ever really made it big? Not that many. Yeah, most of them, and then they kind of fizzle. But all these people you ask, as we said the other week, kids, you know, they don't say, what do you want to be when you grow up? They don't say, I want to be a fireman, or I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a nurse. I want to be on American Idol, or I want to be on The Voice, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. Or I want to be this star or that star. Idolizing rather than seeking what is truly within them, the reality of who they are in God. So for Paul here, we've got, you know, he tends to think the reality of God should be obvious. In a religious sense, a spiritual sense, the reality of God should be obvious to anyone. Just simply from the fact of existence. The existence of God is not the goal of reason. The existence of God is the premise for right reason. You can't reason rightly if God doesn't exist. And that's the way Paul approaches this in his diatribe. And what can be known about God is not simply found by what is out there, but from human experience and what is in here, human intuition. Humans are without excuse, therefore, because they knew God, but they didn't acknowledge God. They acknowledged themselves and their desires as opposed to acknowledging God and what God would have them to do. Now, any of that fit anybody today that you know of? A lot of folks, right? A lot of folks. And he said there's a difference in simply knowing about God and acknowledging or recognizing God's preeminence. And so for Paul, idolatry then is here. Idolatry is defined here. It is claiming to be wise, knowing that God's there, claiming to be wiser than that, and ignoring God. Ignoring God. Exchanging what is true for a lie. Willful disobedience is what idolatry is. And when that happens, do you have a proper perception of the world? You start to perceive the world in skewed ways. I guess kind of like some of these impressionist painters. Oh, it is very overwhelming, and the world is so in your face that it's difficult to not see it except in skewed, as I said, kind of like, in skewed ways, kind of like those impressionist painters, you know, that you look at those things and say, what? You turn it this way, and then you turn it this way, and you turn it this way, and you still don't know what it is, right? Yeah. And so, you know, he says, what happens, we look in a distorted way. Why? Because the world around is distorted, and we choose, rather than looking at God, we choose to try and look through the lens of the distorted lens of the world around us. You ever pick up somebody's glasses that aren't yours and put them on, and you say, whoa. Let me tell you, Mary and I could never swap glasses. I'm surprised hers aren't as thick as Coke bottles. But, you know, we could never swap glasses. But, you know, yeah, you go and you pick up somebody and you think they're your glasses, or you, whose glasses are these? You pick them up and, you, and all of a sudden you got this terrible headache. Yeah. Because it, you know, talk about blind as a bat. The bat can see better than they can. Unless they got their glasses on, right? And so we got that, and we've got this whole skewed way of looking at things. So what are the reasons that Paul gives then for ignoring God? Well, wickedness. We've already seen that. Wickedness, not glorifying God. No gratitude. They didn't honor him. They didn't give him thanks for what he had done. They have futile minds. What he means by that is their minds have gotten into idol worship. What they're doing is futile. It's futile. It doesn't do any good. Doesn't get them anywhere. They glory in things. They exchange, claiming to be wise, they became fools, exchanged the glory of the immortal God for what? Images. Images resembling mortal man, or birds, or animals, or reptiles. So they exchanged what was true to worship created things. To worship created things. Now I know people don't do that these days. Great God, Mercedes. Well, they live a good life, but not a Christian life, because you can't live a Christian life without Christ. But they live a good life, seem to be living a godly life, cleanliness. Obviously, if they're living a life of cleanliness, they're right next to godliness, right? Right. No. Yes. You know, that's, you know, they do that, and they look at, and they think they're okay. You know, I'm okay, you're okay, all God's children are okay. That wasn't the title of the book, but, you know, basically, I'm okay, you're okay, the book that was written. Yeah, those kinds of things. And that's what they were doing, though. They had gotten so skewed by the world telling them, what? It's your thing. Do what you want to do. Sorry, just another musical reference, right? I can't tell you who to sock it to. Back in the 70s, yeah. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. You know, they get this whole skewed view, and basically, and really, if you want to know the truth, what makes it so interesting these days, and sometimes so difficult, is the busters are a little bit that way, the millennials are more that way, and the generation coming after the millennials are even more that way. I mean, people used to say situational ethics and how horrible that was. There's a whole lot of no ethics, but it's all situational. And depending on where one is, it is not uncommon, and I find this more and more these days, it's not uncommon for someone who's high school or college age or to hold two totally opposite ends of the spectrum on the same issue and not see a problem with that, depending on, well, I'm with this group today, and this is how they're dealing with it. Oh, but here's this little, so I'll get with this group over here, and we're dealing with it this way, and they don't see the fact that they're on both ends of the spectrum at the same time. So it's whatever feels good, whatever happens, whatever's going on now, whatever I think is right now, that's what's right. In fact, one of the things of postmodernism is that there is no absolute truth. The truth is whatever the truth is today in this moment for me. And it might be the same tomorrow, but it might be something different tomorrow on the same thing. No, so it can't be absolute. There's absolutely no absolute truth, which is what that's what they say. There is absolutely no such thing as absolute truth. But wait a minute, didn't they just state an absolute truth? But it doesn't click. And that's what was going on here, too. It's not just postmodern. It's something that's gone on for a long, long time, where people, you know, they choose, well, no, it's about me in this moment, not here. And that can change. And so that's what makes it really difficult sometimes to and looking at your questions to deal with people that way. And they, well, I'm good and I give this and I do that and I help this person and I stopped and handed out, you know, $20 bills to 30 people standing on street corners. I need to go stand on a street corner if they're doing that. No. And they say, so I'm fine. Unitarian Universalism. And as a Unitarian Universalist church on State Park Road, and they've just built a new sanctuary. But Unitarian Universalists basically believe eventually everybody's going to get there. And it's not uncommon in a Unitarian Universalist service, one meeting somebody might read from the Bible and they discuss it. The next meeting they may plumb the depths of Thoreau on Walden Pond. And everybody talks about it. That'd take more than one session. Right? Or they may read from the Tripitaka or the Three Baskets of Buddhism and talk about that. You know, or might read from the Constitution and talk about that. You know, and, but whatever philosophy at that particular point in time, you know, everybody's going to eventually make it. You just have to find your own way. Yes, highly pluralistic. Anything and everything goes. Yes, Christianity goes, Judaism goes, Hinduism goes, Islam goes. Humanistic philosophy goes, Epicureanism goes, anything goes. Well, guess what? That's what was going on there. Anything goes. Anything goes. And Paul's dealing with that in this particular place, in this particular point. Anything goes. But he goes on to say, you know, choices bring consequences, though. Choices bring consequences. And so that's where we get to verses 24 and following. Therefore, because they made these choices, God gave them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to dishonoring their bodies among themselves. Because, why? Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature or the creations rather than God. God gave them up or gave them over here in verse 24. Verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Verse 28, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and improper conduct. So it's that, okay, learn through the consequences. The consequences are the actions. My father had colon cancer, got through that, got over it. When he died, still didn't have colon cancer. But it was straight lung cancer. Do I think that God decided my father was going to have colon cancer and lung cancer to get him back for something? No. My father smoked almost all his life. Colon cancer. Number one cause of colon cancer is smoking. A lot of people don't know that. Found that out. Number one cause of colon cancer is smoking. Oh, I know. Well, they do. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't God. My father lived with the consequences. Or died with the consequences. Right. Right. But it's much more likely. Right. 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 No. Yeah. Yeah, and that's true, Sue. And by the way, I've heard chaplains over the years and chaplain residents at the hospital from a particular Christian denomination that we'll leave unnamed, but y'all can probably figure it out, started in Scotland, but with John Calvin, and to end up saying, no, it is the will of God. God is sovereign, and God made that decision, and we've gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth about, and ultimately I've come back. Do you think that really helps that person, to tell them it's God's will that they did that? Right. Well, and it's no, and just like, well, you know, and we say that, no, I don't think God gave that to my father. My father reaped the consequences. The person that ends up having to have the walls taken down, and they end up on the show because they had to have the walls taken down just to get them out of the house to get them to the doctor because they're so obese, and they die of, you know, heart attack because everything's clogged up. Did God do that to them? No, they chose to do and do and do for whatever reason. And there may have been a genetic disposition. You know, some people have a genetic disposition towards putting on more weight than others. But eventually, they reap the consequences of what?
We all know God provided them enough money to buy that.
Well, yeah.
Well, it's not any different than going to the doctor. The doctor tells you something wrong, or you tell you what you need to do.
And you ignore it. You have the consequences. Yeah, same thing. So, you know, and what Paul is saying here is, God didn't do this stuff to these folks. God gave them over to doing whatever they were doing, and they reaped the consequences. If they continued to ignore God, that was the point. If they continued to ignore God and continue to ignore the warnings, then God left them to their own devices at that point. Yeah. There are consequences. A lot of folks, as we said this morning, don't like because there's accountability and consequences to the gospel. And they're accepting the gospel. So the results of ignoring God. God sometimes allows people to live without Him and suffer the consequences of their actions that they may bring on themselves. It's not God's active judgment, it's God's passive judgment. And that was one of the questions in here. How do you define active judgment and passive judgment of God? We just did. We just did. Discuss how Romans 1 describes the wrath of God as passive judgment compared to God's active judgment. God gave them over. Passive judgment. I'm not going to go out here and say, gotcha. But there comes a point in time when you ignore me and you keep doing this that I'm just going to, okay, hands off, let's see. Will you learn and come back? Doesn't mean that God abandons us, but sometimes God gives us, God says, okay, you need to learn. You're not listening. You need to learn. Free choice. Oh, yeah. I mean, how many times did I say to the boys, don't do, I've been there, done that, didn't get a T-shirt. A couple of times, been there, done that, made that decision, and it messed up the T-shirt. And they, what did they do? 8 out of 10 times, they went and did it anyway. That's true. That's very true. So, you know, we live with those kinds of things and those kinds of consequences, and causes are linked to effects. And that's what Paul's telling them here. You know, causes are linked to effects. And it also especially has to do with cause and effect with following God or ignoring God. Being trapped in the sin or coming out of the sin. And sin has consequences not only for us, but sin has consequences for others as well. So what does he allow people to do? Sinful desires. Hearts to impurity. They were worshiping the created rather than the Creator. Dishonoring passions, verses 26 and 27, where women and men give up natural relationships for others, and so then God says, okay, then you receive in your own person the penalty for your error. You know, Paul is using this to say, here is kind of, if you totally ignore God, it can go to all kinds of horrible things and consequences. Continuing to ignore God, ignore God, ignore God, and doing your own thing. But then he also talks in verses 28 and following about some of these things that really harm society and even the church. Since they didn't see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and improper conduct, and they were filled with what? Wickedness? Evil? Greed or covetousness? Malice? Envy? Murder? Strife? Deceit? Malignity? That means they were maligning. They're gossips? Haters of God? Insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. You'd point that out to your kids. No. Disobedient to parents. Foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. What he gives here are vices that are destructive both to persons and to society. Right? I mean, haughtiness doesn't just destroy the person. It destroys relationships in society around them. Deceitfulness, gossip, boastful, inventors of evil. You know, we can come up with all kinds of horrible ways to do people in, or not to do them in, but cause them great pain, can't we, as human beings? So, you know, these are things that don't just harm the person who does them. They harm relationships in society. They destroy society. They destroy the very essence of what God the Creator wants for them. They're the results of pride, haters of God, insolent, arrogant. They lack a sense of right and wrong. All of these show willful rebellion, willful disobedience against God. And what Paul says here is, though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they approve those who practice them. They not only do them, but they, hey, come over here and join. Let's go out and do this together. And what he's saying here is willful rebellion and disobedience brings judgment. All have sinned. All deserve judgment. And willful disobedience brings judgment. The consequences of willfully disobeying God brings judgment. The hope is that in the judgment that it brings, we will find our way back. That's the hope. However, Paul also knows, and I think part of what he's saying here too is, we need to be guarded and very careful because you do it one time and you feel really bad, right? You know it's wrong, you feel really bad. And you beg for forgiveness. I won't do that again. And then you end up in the same situation and you do it again and you feel bad, but not quite as bad as you did the first time. Yeah, and then, that's right, Jim. Next thing you know, you don't feel quite as bad the third time and the fourth time and the fifth time. By the time you get to the tenth time, it's just normal. It's just normal. And those, what Paul is trying to say here, those are the results of willfully ignoring God. You end up eventually getting stuck in a rut, and you have to deal with the consequences. And as I am wont to say, and I said the other week, what's a rut? It's a grave with both ends knocked out. A rut is a grave with both ends knocked out. And sometimes you get so low. One of the things we used to say, you're so low, you'd have to climb on a ladder to reach a snake's belly in a rut. But we get stuck that way sometimes. And the only way to get out is with God's help and the help of others around us who care. And that's what Paul's trying to do here. Yes, Susan. Judge not, lest you not be judged, for the judgment that you use, in other words, the standard you use, guess what? When it comes to judging you, that's the same standard that's going to be used. Right. So what goes around comes around.
Right. And in context with what we're thinking now, and with how he's treated, everyone's going to be judged. When you think about the stories of the woman caught in adultery,
go and sin no more.
I mean, when you think about
There are differences, and yet there are some, every now and then there are some similarities. Jesus, of course, Jesus says that the Son of Man did not come to judge the world. For God sent not His Son into the world to judge it, but that through Him the world might be saved. And what Jesus is basically saying, and what Paul is saying here is, that we judge ourselves by what we do, oftentimes. We're bringing that upon ourselves. You know, this great white throne judgment out there that people talk about in the book of Revelation. I don't know if y'all got the thing in the mail that I did or not. And the first thing I wanted to do was circle every S on the end of Revelations. Something at the Greenville Tech, you know. All this, it's not Revelations. It's Apocalypse to Ioana, the Apocalypse to John, the Revelation to John. But, you know, it just... But this whole thing of judging and judging and judging. And what Jesus says is, I came not to judge, but to save the world. And yet, we're judging ourselves in this great white throne thing out here. When we die, it's appointed unto man. Hebrews says, it's appointed unto man once to die, then the judgment. He tried to. And that's where I was getting ready to go, Bobby, was in the temple. But it was. Like the individual. It depended on their attitude and what was within their hearts. Yeah. No. Well, and you notice he didn't jump on the other guy that jumped onto him, and he just said to this guy, today you'll be with me in paradise, or from this day you'll be with me in paradise. Right. Well, the person that needs to be judged in our daily walk technically is self. But it's a whole lot easier for us to look out here and judge everybody else, because then we don't have to look in here. You know, you. You know, we pick people that we can be better than. That's right. My boys pick at them and say, one at me, three at you. Yeah, because three are pointing back at you. But, you know, when I tease them or pick at them, but at least I didn't name them Sue. That might have made them tougher. That might have made them tougher, you know, a boy named Sue. But it is difficult. But there are times where righteous indignation needs to come into play. But I think we have to be careful in how we do it, where we choose, and make sure that we're being led not so that we feel better because we just condemn somebody else because we think they're worse. And you know, Paul here though is still saying this passive judgment. You know, you've still got to make this choice. What you're doing is judging yourselves by being involved in these kinds of things. And God has said, it comes a point where God says, okay, till you learn, I'm going to be here, but I'm not going to yank you back. And so, you know, Jesus, there were those times with the money changers, et cetera. But when he said, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. He wasn't pointing to the money changers. He was pointing to the priests that were standing around that did that. And in Matthew 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you do this and this, but you don't do that. And you know, so he was, yes, it was groups, but it was also individuals in groups. And I think there he was trying to encourage the people that they didn't have to be so self-righteously pious as the scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees were. But I think he was also in that trying to tell them, look, you need to look at yourself and figure out what, and back off of it, or you're going to end up missing out on the kingdom of God that you think you're the heads of. So Jesus came, yes, he had that, but Jesus also came speaking to the religiosity and the self-righteous piety of others that cut themselves off. The older brother in the parable of the prodigal and the father, it's really interesting. We like to talk about the prodigal and the father and the prodigal and the father and the prodigal and the father. But, you know, there was an older brother, and he was being warned. And the audience there, there are scribes and Pharisees and tax collectors and other sinners. And that's the audience to whom Jesus is telling that parable. And the scribes and Pharisees, in the setup for that those parables in Luke 15, the scribes and Pharisees are the older brothers. And they're the ones, when the sheep is found, that don't want to rejoice. And when the coin is found, that don't want to rejoice. And so he's warning them, you know, you can lose out if you're not careful. So, you know, Jesus, while he came not to judge, per se, as we think of judgment, he did come sometimes to speak to people in such a way that they needed to realize they were bringing judgment upon themselves by their choices not to follow what God would have them to do. So it's kind of a balancing act there. Paul, Gospels deal more with the life and the teachings of Jesus and how to see that and come to God in Christ. The epistles, and particularly the epistles of Paul, have as their major focus, okay, you're in this hostile world. How do you live as a Christian in a hostile world? And he sees Christians who are, or people who are in the church who are claiming to be Christians. This is not just people that are outside the church. There are folks in the church who are going and doing all these things, and he's saying, wait a minute, that doesn't wash. And when you end up falling because of this and getting hurt because of this, and you wonder, well, God, why did you do this to me? It wasn't God, it was your choice. You knew better. It was your choice. You know, there are a lot of folks on roles in churches who know better. But they still make the bad choices and they don't, you know, you don't see them until there's a crisis. You know, the crisis Christians, as I call them. And so, you know, it's a fine line to walk. And I really don't have much. Ooh, it's Acts 7. I really don't have a whole lot of stomach for the guys that stand on the street corners and wave the Bibles and condemn. There are plenty of times I want to condemn, but there are plenty of times I need to be the one condemned too. So I don't want somebody doing that. And send $25 and we'll give you this bottle of water from the Jordan River, same water Jesus was baptized in. You can sprinkle it around it as if it hadn't evaporated and fallen somewhere else. It might be in the Arctic by now. But thank y'all. Thank you for all this give and take and everything. And God bless you. Go in peace. And I'll look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Dr. DeVinny will be here next Sunday night. Mary and I will be out of town.